The content of this program is intended for an audience of people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Our cover story, The Riskiest Show on Earth, Trump's Impulse Diplomacy, by Brian Bennett. The cover illustration shows President Trump with Kim Jong-un. Make sure that we get in this edition's interview feature. We go right to the back of the magazine. In this edition, it's called Six Questions. Time says, Lawrence Tribe, the Harvard Law professor, on his new book, To End a Presidency, Trump's Pardon Power, and the Trouble with Impeachment. Question 1. You write that sometimes discussion of impeachment is reasonable, but most of the time it's, quote, needless and harmful, unquote. Where does discussion of impeaching President Trump fall in that divide today? Answer. I think it's certainly reasonable to be thinking about it. What I think is unreasonable is expecting it to serve the purpose of a magic wand. It is totally predictable that, however justifiable it might be to remove this president, it simply isn't going to happen through the impeachment process, at least not in the very near future. It's premature to call for it because it's going to be like the boy who cried wolf. This is not something that we can take lightly or do more than once to any given president. Question. You have called for lawmakers to begin impeachment proceedings, though. Answer. Ever since Special Counsel Robert Mueller was appointed, I've thought it important to basically chill out and wait until we know more. Question. Do you think people are overstating the threat that one man can pose to the Republic? Answer. No, I think the framers knew, and we are now seeing that even one man, if he is not dedicated to the country, but dedicated to his own fame and wealth, and backed up by a political party that has signed on for the ride, can pose an existential threat. It's, in a sense, one man. It's also, in a sense, one man and millions who back him up. Question. Does it make sense for Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, to discuss impeachment as the only remedy for a president's illegal behavior? Answer. It makes sense from his PR point of view. They know that impeachment is very unlikely, and if it occurs, it's very unlikely to result in conviction. But the idea that a president is so much above the law that he cannot be indicted, I think, is false. The notion that you would have to go through an elaborate impeachment process before arresting and indicting a president is a fantasy. Question. Does the president have the power to pardon himself? Answer. No. That's so profoundly inconsistent with the premises of the whole American system of government that we should not allow ourselves to be distracted by it. Question. How do we strike a balance between the harm of potentially living under a tyrant and the chaos that could be caused by the first successful removal of a U.S. president? Answer. If I could answer that in just a few lines, there wouldn't have been a need for this book. One of the main factors to take into account is, would we favor removing the president through impeachment, even if it happened to be a president we liked and had voted for? We have to keep in mind that congressional oversight can constrain a president who is otherwise a renegade and can do it in ways that are less likely to leave lots of people feeling disenfranchised. Final question. Is there something about this political moment that the founders failed to anticipate when they created a power that could cause national trauma? Answer. I don't think they could have anticipated the rise of social media and the tunnel vision it would generate. They didn't anticipate the rise of political parties and the division they represent. They didn't have a crystal ball. But it's interesting that those of us who've looked at what's happened since still can't come up with a better structure for getting rid of a president. Interview for Time conducted by Katie Riley. Subject of the interview, Lawrence Tribe, Harvard Law professor, on his new book, To End a Presidency. Tribe is spelled T-R-I-B-E. Going now to the front of the magazine, and we go right to the section called For the Record, the one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated with a line drawing, a headline or caption or quotation in bold, or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page, a story illustrated by the year in bold red, 1983. Caption explains, year that U.S. Air Force Captain William Howard Hughes, Jr. disappeared. On June 6, authorities arrested him after discovering he had been living in California under a false identity. In the right margin of the page is a recurring feature within a feature called Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, baobabs. Research suggests climate change is killing ancient trees. Under Good Week, Bao. A Pixar short about a dumpling baby premieres June 15th. Bao is spelled B-A-O, as in Mandarin language. In the lower right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from T.J. Oshie, Washington Capitals forward, when a reporter asked what his father would think of the NHL team's first Stanley Cup win. And the quotation from T.J. Oshie, Washington Capitals forward, quote, my dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and he doesn't remember a lot of stuff, but you bet your ass he's going to remember this one, unquote. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic, new 200 quadrillion. Caption explains, number of calculations per second performed by the world's most powerful supercomputer, Summit, which was unveiled on June 8th at Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. 200 quadrillion calculations per second. In the lower left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. In its first report addressing how universities handle sexual harassment. And the quotation from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, quote, there is no evidence to suggest that current policies, procedures, and approaches have resulted in a significant reduction in sexual harassment, unquote. In the middle left margin of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 172. Caption explains, number of American children killed by the flu during the 2017-18 flu season, more than in any other non-pandemic year on record, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. 172 American children. In the upper left corner of the page, a story illustrated by a quotation from Clinton Portis, former NFL running back, opening up about dealing with the pressures of fame as part of the Players Union mental health awareness campaign. The quotation from former NFL running back Clinton Portis, quote, people expect us to be like Teflon, but we're just men, unquote. In the upper center of the page, as a quotation, is a story illustrated by a quotation from Matteo Salvini, Italy's interior minister, defending his controversial decision to turn away a ship carrying more than 600 migrants. The quotation from Italy's Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, quote, "Rescuing lives is a duty. Transforming Italy into an enormous refugee camp is not." Caption goes on to say, Spain offered to accept the ship. In the center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Glenda Jackson, actor, after winning a Tony Award on June 10th. Quotation in all black and all caps from Glenda Jackson, quote, "Well, I was tempted to say, it's taken you long enough, but that was certainly too rude," unquote. Caption goes on to say, she had been nominated 4 times before scoring for her role in Edward Albee's 3 Tall Women, Glenda Jackson. That is all the content from For the Record. We now go to the main section called The Brief. And in The Brief is the recurring sidebar feature called News Ticker. 3 news items stacked top to bottom in the right margin. Item number 1 on the top. Antarctic ice loss tripled in past decade. Antarctica is losing ice at a staggering rate, dumping about 2 billion tons of ice into the ocean every year, scientists found in a study published in the journal Nature on June 13th. And it's getting worse. Of the nearly 3 trillion tons of ice loss since 1992, 40% occurred over the past 5 years. Middle item. Ex-Senate aide charged in leak case. James Wolfe, a former Senate Intelligence Committee staffer, was arrested June 7th in an investigation into classified information leaks. He was charged with 3 felony counts of lying to the FBI about his contacts with journalists. Prosecutors in the case also secretly seized years' worth of phone and email records from 1 of the journalists. Final item. North America wins World Cup bid. The U.S., Mexico, and Canada will jointly host the 2026 Soccer World Cup. FIFA, FIFA, announced on the eve of 2018's tournament. The joint bid's success came in the first vote since the allegations of corruption that surrounded Russia's and Qatar's being awarded the 2018 and 2022 World Cups. Still in the brief, and we are now in the milestones page. Main item, under died, Anthony Bourdain, culinary ambassador. Observance by René Redzepi. Time notes, Redzepi is a chef who runs the 2 Michelin-starred restaurant Noma. Redzepi writes, "No one in our industry was bigger than Anthony Bourdain, who died on June 8th at 61. There's Auguste Escoffier, and then there's Tony. Actually, he was more like our Elvis Presley. Famous, but also personal. Everyone felt like they knew him. The first time I met him was in Tokyo in 2011. We met for dinner at a kaiseki restaurant, and although the crew for his TV show, No Reservations, was there, it was otherwise just the 2 of us. We immediately hit it off, and the conversation just flowed. For 3 or 4 hours, we talked about food, about Japan, just the kind of easy conversation that makes you feel good. We met up again a few days later in Ishikawa, where he and his crew were shooting at Cook It Raw, a gathering where a group of chefs is introduced to the local food culture and then prepares a meal. On the last day, we were all in the kitchen, working really hard to prep our dishes for dinner. Tony stepped in and made us lunch. It was on the porch, and he grilled some meat. He was like the barbecuing dad, standing there with a beer in his hand. That was a stand-up move. That was a real chef thing to do. I've never seen anything like the response to his death. Everyone in the industry felt it. We were all in awe of him. He was like the Milky Way, and we're all just small specks. Chef René Redzepi of two Michelin star restaurant Noma, writing about Anthony Bourdain. This item is accompanied by a full-color photograph. Caption says, Bourdain pictured in Hanoi in 2016. He is at a table, and he's wearing a dark blue T-shirt. Under died, David Douglas Duncan, cameraman. Observance by John Lengard. Time says Lengard is a photographer and was a picture editor for Life magazine. Lengard writes, David Douglas Duncan, the Life photographer who died on June 7th at 102, was in Tokyo in 1950 when the Korean War began. He had been a Marine officer during World War II, so his pictures of war had the breathtaking clarity and intimacy of a lover. He was not a lover of war, but of the Marine Corps. He knew what a Marine was doing on the front line, what he was thinking, and why, and he showed it. His pictures were collected in the best-selling book, This Is War. The photos have no captions. None are needed. It wasn't just war. He was alone with Richard Nixon the night Nixon was writing his acceptance speech for the 1968 Republican presidential nomination. He made some of the best pictures of Nixon I've ever seen, unguarded and understandable. Our perception of a subject often depends on a photographer recording a telling gesture. He did that with Nixon. DDD brought you into the room and, as he did in all his pictures, brought you along on his adventures. John Lengard writing about David Douglas Duncan. This item also accompanied by a photograph. It's a black and white headshot of David Douglas Duncan with his camera. Under died, British actor Eunice Gayson, who was the first Bond girl on June 8th at 90. Under died, Gina Turgell, a Holocaust survivor known for comforting Anne Frank, on June 7th at 95. Under celebrated, the 94th birthday of George H.W. Bush, the first former U.S. president to hit that age, on June 12th, 94. Under appointed, 11 female lawmakers to Spain's 17-member cabinet, the most in the nation's history. Their June 7th swearing-in gave Spain the most proportionally female cabinet in Europe. Undercharged, former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort and his aide Konstantin Kilimnik with witness tampering by special counsel Robert Mueller. The June 8th indictment is the case's first to involve an American and a Russian together. Under approved, AT&T's $85.4 billion purchase of Time Warner on June 12th. A judge ruled that the federal government had failed to prove the deal violates antitrust law. $85.4 billion, AT&T's purchase of Time Warner. Under-resolved. A 27-year dispute over the use of the word Macedonia by Greece and the nation to be known as the Republic of North Macedonia. On the facing page, still in the brief, in this subsection is news. The subsection is Good Question by Abigail Abrams. And the headline is, What does the Supreme Court's Ohio decision mean for voting rights? When the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Ohio's method of cleaning up its voter rolls in a 5-4 decision on June 11th, the ruling focused in large part on technical interpretations of federal voting law. But it also represented a broader debate about partisan visions of democracy. The case centered on Larry Harmon, a software engineer who found he had been taken off the voter registration list when he showed up to cast a ballot in 2015. In Ohio, his home state, election officials can send residency confirmation notices to anyone who skips one federal election cycle. If a voter fails to respond and doesn't vote in the next 4 years, that person is purged from the rolls. Ohio sent Harmon such a notice, but he said he never got it. So, unable to vote, he went to court. All states have systems for clearing registration lists of people who move away. The question here was whether failing to vote could trigger this process. Justice Samuel Alito wrote in his majority opinion that even if Harmon never got the message, Ohio's attempt to contact voters meant the state didn't violate the National Voter Registration Act. The case exposed a deep divide in how Americans interpret the idea of safeguarding the vote. Conservatives tend to argue that the vote needs to be protected from fraud and call for more intensive scrutiny of voter rolls. Parenthetically, many studies, including a 2014 report by the nonpartisan Government Accountability Office, have found no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the U.S. Meanwhile, liberals say the ability to vote is what needs protecting, and that obstacles to doing so are meant to disenfranchise their constituencies, as tactics that make it harder to register disproportionately hurt poor and minority voters. Harmon's lawyers noted that 7,500 eligible Ohioans would have been unable to vote in the 2016 presidential election without an earlier decision in his favor. Ohio's Secretary of State said on June 12th that voters won't be purged from the rolls before November's midterms. But now that the Supreme Court overturned the previous ruling, voting rights advocates fear the decision's impact could spread beyond Ohio in future elections. At least 6 other states have similar laws, although Ohio's process moves quickest, and others are watching the case. Quote, "There's a real risk that other secretaries of state will see this as an excuse to kick people off the voting rolls," unquote, says Daniel Takagi, a co-counsel on the lawsuit for Harmon and a voting rights expert at Ohio State University. Some advocates said the ruling represents a good opportunity to push for Election Day registration, which could provide a fail-safe if voters are accidentally purged. But until then, quote, "some people are going to fall through the cracks," unquote, says Lana Akison, an expert on voting rights and election law at the University of New Mexico. Quote, "those are going to be disproportionately Democratic voters," unquote. entire article by Abigail Abrams. In the left margin of the page is another version of the feature news ticker. Again, three news items stacked top to bottom. Top item: Salmonella outbreak sickens citizens. Correction: Salmonella outbreak sickens dozens. At least 60 people have fallen ill and dozens have been hospitalized with salmonella linked to pre-cut melon sold in U.S. grocery stores. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention traced the outbreak to a facility in Indiana, and the company issued a recall notice for 8 states. Middle item: a Brexit-Russia link revealed. Arron Banks, a millionaire who bankrolled a campaign for the UK to leave the EU, held previously undisclosed meetings with Russia's ambassador to the UK before the vote, according to emails seen by British newspapers. Banks also admitted to giving a phone number for the Trump team to the Russian government. Final item: Trump critic loses in GOP primary. South Carolina Representative Mark Sanford, who has been critical of President Trump, lost his House race on June 12th to a pro-Trump challenger, State Representative Katie Arrington, after Trump urged voters to punish him. Sanford is the second sitting House Republican to lose a congressional primary this year. Also on this page, under the section titled Survival, the headline is Lost in the Wilderness. A South Korean hiker who was rescued on June 7th after 6 days lost in the Australian bush said she survived by drinking from a waterfall. Hear Other Unlikely Survival Stories by Sarah Nugent. She lists 3 items left to right. First item: stuck in the mud. An 11-year-old girl with Asperger's syndrome survived 4 days in Florida's alligator-infested swamps in 2010 after wandering away from her home to see nature. She ate plants and slept inside a hollow log. Middle item: into the woods. In 2016, a 3-year-old boy wandered into a Siberian forest populated by wolves and bears and was lost for 3 days. The chocolate he was carrying in his pocket sustained him until he was found by his uncle. Final item: rescue dogs. A Canadian dog walker was stranded in the British Columbia backcountry in 2017 after she fell, hurt herself, and lost her phone. But her 3 dogs helped keep her warm during the 3-day ordeal. Going forward, we're now at the next major section, The View. And the first page is the said subsection, Society. And the headline is, Things Are Never What They Seem, by Belinda Luscombe. She starts with a quotation, quote, "Sometimes I wonder how all those who do not write, compose, or paint can manage to escape the madness, the melancholia, the panic fear which is inherent to the human condition," unquote, wrote Graham Greene in the autobiography Ways of Escape, which chef and TV host Anthony Bourdain kept on his nightstand. Bourdain's June 8th suicide, coupled with that of fashion designer Kate Spade, was a 1-2 punch to our belief that there are some people who are living the perfect life, that each of them chose to end an existence that, to outsiders, seemed idyllic and enviable, is a mystery to most of us, especially because these were not teenagers or lost 20-somethings, but two people who might reasonably be expected to have reached some sort of self-knowledge, or to have made peace with their demons. So many spectators of Bourdain's and Spade's lives saw in them reflections of the lives they would have liked to have lived. Spade created what many women would consider the ideal situation. Her world was filled with creativity, beauty, family, and meaningful work. Having brought into being a fashion line alongside her husband, she sold it and was able to take years off to raise her daughter. She had a successful, artistic, family-centric business that gave her time to be a parent and that brought joy to many. After she died, many women spoke of how she made them feel seen. How her upbeat, quirky, feminine handbags and style made them realize they were not alone. Bourdain managed to be masculine without being swaggeringly macho. He was rugged and adventurous and knew how to use big knives, but he had his own literary imprint. Tall and handsome, he got to travel to exotic locales, and he won awards, fame, and wealth. Plus, he ate so well. He was also seen as a rare male hero. He was also seen as a rare male hero in the Me Too movement for championing his girlfriend, Asia Argento's, claims against Harvey Weinstein, and for siding with women over fellow chefs. After his death, Bourdain was almost universally praised for his ability to meet people just about anywhere and fairly portray their culture to viewers who might otherwise fail to appreciate its offerings. What more could a person want? Yet, these two could not bear to live their lives any longer. Apart from yearning for more help for those who struggle with depression and mental illness, parenthetically, Spade's husband, Andy, said she had fought depression for years. What do we do with the information that those whose lives we admire cannot bear to live? How do we process the reality that all they'd had and done were not bulwark enough against darkness? What hope is there for the rest of us? It's not much of a solace, but perhaps one thing these deaths could remind us of is the uselessness of envy. As with many behaviors that were once considered vices, greed, sloth, lust, envy reflects a miscalculation in the relative worth of things. When we look at lives like Spade's and Bourdain's, it can make our own feel wanting. We haven't started our own companies or turned our work experience into a book and TV show. Sometimes we can barely get through the day. They're happier and more fulfilled because we are not as hardworking or talented as they are. Their lives look better than ours, therefore they must be better people than we are. Our desire to turn Bourdain's and Spade's successes into a judgment on our own is rooted in a flawed comparison because of incomplete data. How many lives are not as they appear? Happiness is not the end result of a sum of accomplishments. The people whose wealth, wardrobe, job, talent we wish we had have their own struggles. Bourdain seemed to hint at his when, during a particularly halcyon episode of Parts Unknown, he asked in a voiceover, quote, "What do you do after your dreams come true?" unquote. if our envy is misplaced, maybe there's also a case to be made for having more compassion. If people's lives aren't as amazingly blissful as they appear, perhaps people are not as evil or stupid as they appear either. Bourdain once flew small-town newspaper columnist Marilyn Haggerty, whose sweet review of her local Olive Garden had been mocked on the Internet, to New York City to dine at the restaurant of the moment, per se, and then published a book of her columns. Spade donated boxes of new clothing and bags to the How Her Full Foundation, which helps young women succeed by ensuring that a lack of business attire doesn't obscure their talent or undermine their confidence. How Her Full is spelled capital P-O-W, capital H-E-R-F-U-L, the How Her Full Foundation. Final paragraph. It seems both Spade and Bourdain already knew that outward impressions of people's lives are often wildly off base. Entire article by Belinda Luscombe. Time adds this paragraph after the article. Time says, if you or someone you know may be contemplating suicide, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. 1-800-273-8255. This article was also accompanied by photographs in color of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain. They're separate photographs, but they are side by side, each a half-length shot. The caption says, Spade and Bourdain. Kate Spade is on the left, Anthony Bourdain on the right. On this page is the sidebar feature called Reading List. Time calls it Highlights from Stories on time.com/ideas. Time lists three items, top to bottom. Top item, the best books of 2018 so far. Time staffers review and recommend their favorite novels and nonfiction books that have come out this year, including a fictional account of a marriage confronting a wrongful conviction and an unnervingly timely analysis of Shakespeare's portrayals of tyrants. Middle item, The Invisible Ethics of Body Hair. Moral philosopher and author of the recent book Perfect Me, Beauty as an Ethical Ideal, Heather Widows details how her constant shaving and plucking and waxing have changed our views of... I'll repeat that for clarity. Heather Widows details how our constant shaving and plucking and waxing have changed our views of natural bodies and explains why there are deeper insidious costs. Final item, Restoring Trust Across America. Former Time Editor-in-Chief Nancy Gibbs writes that as the public says it has lost faith in the media, quote, unless you believe that the country has gotten better and stronger and fairer as trust has declined, then we all have a stake in rebuilding some measure of faith in each other and our core institutions. Unquote. All three items from time.com/ideas. On the facing page, under sports, the headline is The Beautiful Game's Ugly Side by Ken Benzinger. Time notes, Benzinger is an investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News and the author of Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. Just over 3 years ago, the U.S. Department of Justice shocked the world by initiating a pre-dawn raid in Zurich, arresting several international soccer officials. To date, nearly four dozen people have been indicted in the case for exchanging hundreds of millions of dollars in bribes. Many once untouchable administrators have been banned from the sport, including longtime FIFA president Sepp Blatter. And countless fans have had to confront the grim knowledge that rampant corruption has seeped into the game they loved. Their stomachs will not be settled this summer. Take the fact that the World Cup is being held in Russia. Many questions hang over the 2010 decision to award the tournament to the nation, ones that remain unanswered as FIFA's attempt to investigate the choice was stymied when Russia's bid team claimed that all its computers were destroyed after the vote. FIFA, working on the dubious principle that if there are no records, there is no crime, cleared Russia of any wrongdoing. As if to thumb his nose at critics, Vladimir Putin, last fall, made a public show of inviting Blatter to attend the tournament in person, even though FIFA gave Blatter a 6-year ban in 2016 from attending any event. Blatter wasted little time in accepting the Russian leader's offer, and it will be interesting to see where he will be seated at critical matches. Putin is expected to occupy a box with new FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, who has already been subject to 2 ethics complaints. There is more to this article, but in the interest of making sure we get the cover story in, we move forward. We are at the cover story, and the headline is The Dare Me Doctrine by Brian Bennett. Bennett writes, Kim Jong-un had a request. As Donald Trump wooed the North Korean leader inside a former British garrison in Singapore, Kim asked Trump to suspend military exercises by U.S. and South Korean forces on the Korean Peninsula, long a source of concern for Pyongyang's hair-trigger military. It wasn't something that had been negotiated by their staffs, and some of Trump's aides were concerned that the concession would irritate allies. But he calculated that it was worth the risk, and without consulting anyone further, he told Kim on the spot that he'd do it. It was exactly the kind of shoot-from-the-hip move they hate in the pinstriped confines of the State Department. But the moment was classic Trump. Quote, I'll do whatever it takes to make the world a safer place, unquote, he said in a press conference after the summit in response to a question from Time. Quote, if I can save millions of lives by coming here, sitting down and establishing a relationship with someone who's a very powerful man, who's got firm control of a country, and that country has very powerful nuclear weapons, it's my honor to do it. Unquote. The war game concession was just the latest in a series of surprising turns in what may ultimately prove to be a historic moment. Since inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency were blocked from visiting North Korean nuclear sites during the first term of Bill Clinton's presidency, the U.S. and its allies have struggled with the growing threat of a nuclear-armed North Korea. Multi-party agreements, crippling sanctions, and threats of military intervention have failed to prevent the totalitarian state from approaching the ability to strike the U.S. with a nuclear-tipped missile. Now, in less than a year, Trump has gone from threatening Kim with annihilation to the first face-to-face talks between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader. The result was mixed. Trump touted his, quote, terrific relationship, unquote, with Kim, a verbal promise Kim gave him that he was destroying a missile engine test site and Kim's, quote, unwavering commitment to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, unquote. Trump also secured the return of the remains of 5,300 service members who died during the Korean War. But experts pointed out that Kim had made only vague promises of the kind that Pyongyang had violated multiple times before. The summit theater was the latest and most dramatic example of how the impulsive president is upending the global order. 3 days earlier, as he flew to Singapore aboard Air Force One after a testy two-day economic summit with six of the U.S.'s closest allies, Trump had grown livid as he watched Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau declare that the new U.S. trade tariffs were unfair. Scowling at the flat-screen TV in the plane's private office, according to a White House official, Trump ordered his aides to back out of the summit's final communique, which had already been publicly released after 2 days of negotiations. The move was met with stunned protest from Ottawa to London to Paris. But that's how things work now. With each feat of showmanship or fit of pique, Trump is redefining America's role on the world stage. Early on, Trump heeded his top aides when they urged caution. But in the past 6 months, he has taken increasingly dramatic risks, especially in foreign policy. In December, Trump committed to moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, overriding the dire predictions about Middle East chaos. In March, he threatened to impose stiff trade tariffs on China and Europe, then enacted them 2 months later after global markets generally bounced back from initial losses. In May, he withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran, even though Europe, international agencies, and some of his own senior aides said Iran was complying with it. The populist has famously bristled at convention. Quote, if you go into a meeting and say we can't do that, or that's not the way it's been done, you can be assured he's going to want to do it, unquote, says one senior National Security Council official. Quote, he thinks the way it's been done is wrong and stupid and won't work, unquote. But lately, Trump has become increasingly energized by the idea that he's shattering precedent and feels vindicated by the results of his risky moves, according to interviews with more than a dozen friends, aides, and former officials. Quote, he recognizes that people always are running around, it seems, with their hair on fire, unquote, senior White House aide Kellyanne Conway told Time. Quote, he sees that all those attempts by past administrations have been failures, and they have been aborted promises. So, he says, let's just try it a different way, unquote. There is more to this article, and this article does include several mini features. This one is under the heading Viewpoint, and the headline is One Real Summit Win by Beatrice Finn. Time says Finn is the executive director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which won the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. Beatrice Finn writes, quote, a stunning concession, unquote. That was the consensus of the world's media gathered in Singapore, where President Trump announced that the U.S. would halt all military exercises with South Korea. But by saying he would discontinue the war games, Trump is in effect offering to stop the simulated mass murder of North Koreans. Don't let military language sugarcoat this. When you send a nuclear bomber on a dry run, you are practicing the indiscriminate murder of civilians. Each year, that's exactly what South Korea and the U.S. have been doing. It is time to unravel the anachronistic security framework of the constant threat of mass extinction. Last year, 122 states at the UN voted to adopt the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. That means most of the world agrees that any nuclear weapon, anywhere, is an unacceptable threat to all nations. I was in Singapore for the summit to advocate for the treaty as the most appropriate instrument used for Korean denuclearization. The treaty doesn't tweet, it doesn't change its mind on the plane home, and it can't have its ego bruised. It's the only comprehensive, verifiable, and irreversible way to achieve meaningful nuclear disarmament. More than that, it's an international solution. Nuclear war does not respect borders. Any, quote, limited, unquote, nuclear attack on Pyongyang would blanket Seoul in deadly radiation. Beyond the immediate death from nuclear weapons, millions more would die from radiation exposure and resulting famine. That's why the solution must also cross borders. It's not enough for North Korea to give up its weapons program. To fully denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, South Korea would also have to leave the protection of the U.S. nuclear umbrella. Starting that process with the cessation of U.S.-South Korea war games, or rather practicing the mass murder of innocents, is a good step toward ending nuclear weapons. It is not a concession. There is no weakness in giving up something that the majority of nations have decided is illegal. Entire item written by Beatrice Finn, executive director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which won the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. On the facing page, under analysis, the headline is The Machiavellian Mr. Kim by Charlie Campbell. Dateline, Singapore. Kim Jong-un was anything but formidable when he first stepped onto the world stage in 2011. With head bowed, the 27-year-old wept before the casket of his late father, Kim Jong-il. Rumors suggested the scion was a hard-partying libertine, while a CIA psychological profile painted him as an egotist who lashed out savagely at perceived insults. Intelligence officials doubted his rule would last longer than a few years, and if it did, only at the pleasure of North Korean elites who would control him from the shadows. But the young dictator has turned out to be anything but a puppet. Kim defanged the powerful military by purging hundreds of top brass, including his powerful uncle, Jong Song-taik. He transformed the North Korean economy by ceasing collectivization and allowing the marketplace to thrive. The famines that claimed some 500,000 lives between 1993 and 2000 are no more. And he turned a fledgling nuclear program into President Donald Trump's top foreign policy problem. He is estimated to have enough material for up to 60 nuclear bombs and has long-range missiles that can reach any U.S. city. Quote, if your objective is to maintain a dictatorship, the last 5 years under Kim couldn't have been scripted better, unquote, says Daniel Pinkston of Troy University in Seoul. The payoff for that Machiavellian maneuvering came when Trump met Kim in Singapore, giving the North Korean a degree of legitimacy his father and grandfather never achieved. Trump added to Kim's win by nixing the joint U.S.-South Korea military drills that Pyongyang loathes, and by praising Kim effusively. Said Trump, quote, "He's a very talented man. He loves his country very much," unquote. That might be news to the estimated 100,000 North Koreans in forced labor camps who are subjected to abuses that the UN has declared crimes against humanity. Under Kim's regime, dissenters are silenced and border guards are ordered to shoot attempted defectors on sight. Kim ordered the gruesome public execution of his half-brother Kim Jong-nam. Trump looked past all that at the Singapore summit, talking up instead the potential for condos on North Korean beaches. But experts see a different future based on Kim's moves so far. They find Kim's pledge in Singapore of, quote, "unwavering commitment to complete denuclearization," unquote, not much more convincing than the similar agreements he and his predecessors signed and subsequently violated in 1992, 1994, 2005, and 2012. Instead, Kim appears to be exploiting the rivalry between the U.S. and China. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. This is Randall Rickman reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you again for your presence and certainly for your patience with your reader. Please join us next time for Time.